Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time. In each episode of this podcast, we invite a special guest to take us on a tailored tour of the past. Travels Through Time is brought to you in partnership with History Today, Britain's best-loved serious history magazine. You can read articles relating to this podcast and more about our guests at historytoday.com/travels. There is also a special subscription offer for Travels Through Time listeners. 3 issues for just £1 each. You're listening to a snippet of a conversation from the Apollo 11 mission that took Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins to the moon. That should give you a clue about the year we're visiting today. Welcome to Travels Through Time. I'm Peter Moore, and this is the podcast where we invite a special guest to explore 1 year in history through 3 different scenes. Thank you to everyone who's been listening over our first few months. We're now 3 months old, and we've got a growing library of time travels for you to listen back to, from Andrew Roberts in May 1940, Dr. Kate Fullager in December 1776, and many more too. They're all free to download, and you can find them just by scrolling backwards through our feed. In this episode, I'm going to be joined by the writer and cultural historian Cassia St. Clair. Over the past few years, Cassia has established herself as one of Britain's brightest young historians. Her first book, The Secret Lives of Colour, was a Sunday Times bestseller. One critic called it a dazzling and vibrant history of colour, from Van Gogh's wilting yellow sunflowers to Turner's deadly green in Picasso's darkest period. Last year, she published her follow-up, The Golden Thread, is an investigation into how fabric, and that's from linen to lace and polyurethane, has shaped human history. The Golden Thread was a BBC Radio 4 Book of the Week, and it was chosen as a Sunday Times History Book of the Year. I met with Cassia the other day in an office overlooking the River Thames in London. The Golden Thread spans a massive range of human history, from 35,000 BC right through to today, so she had plenty to choose from when I offered her the chance of a bit of time travelling. Welcome to Travels Through Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so let's get started. Your writing spans an enormous swathe of human history from around 35,000 BC to pretty much today. So what year have you decided to visit, and most importantly, why?
So this was a really difficult choice for me. There were so many great periods of history and years and moments to choose from. But I chose 1969 for 2 reasons. One has to do with the year itself, and one is rather more personal. I think 1969 is a very exciting year for all sorts of reasons, and I'm going to talk, you know, really briefly about just one of them. So it's kind of, in a way, almost doing a disservice to the year. But the more personal reason is that when I was working on this book, which is, you know, quite a long period of time for me, and I would be talking to people about the book that I was writing, why I was writing it. You know, people would say, oh, what are you working on? I'd say, oh, I'm writing a book about textiles. And I would just see their eyes sort of glaze over. It was like sort of a power down look, which is hugely dispiriting when you're midway through a book project. And also, I think, really unfair on fabric and textiles, because they are incredibly exciting. And this reaction that, oh, this isn't interesting, or this isn't for me, I find very surprising. And I think 1969 kind of gives a lie to that instinctive reaction that so many people have, because this is a period in time when fabric just really proves itself in this incredible way that I'm going to talk more about. And I think just the fact that this book is about space, or has a chapter that's about space exploration, makes people kind of perk up again and think, oh, actually, maybe this is something that is really interesting. Mm. And that's something that I really liked.
So before we lift off, so to speak, 1969, as you say, is a really vibrant year in terms of our whole human history. And you talk about clothing really having two primary uses, and one of which is to keep us warm, and the second is for display. And 1969 seems a perfect example of us as human beings using clothing for display in all sorts of new and innovative and exciting ways. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the fashions of that year that were happening in the terrestrial sphere, especially maybe perhaps the Western world as we might think about it. So what was going on in terms of fashion?
So this was obviously, the 60s were a hugely exciting time. Shopping and clothing and fabric was seen as a really inspiring way to express yourself. Mm. And that was a really important moment. But also there is a kind of a real link between fashion and space, as odd as it sounds. Because, you know, later on, you see the impact of the moon landing and of space exploration in fashion. You know, people kind of want to dress in this kind of very exciting modern way, as if they've already left the bounds of the Earth and are kind of moving away from it.
Okay, so we're there in the summer of 1969, in July. We're at a moment of really high excitement in terms of fashion in general on Earth. I think it's worth mentioning briefly that just a few weeks after your first scene, so we're hopping forward a bit before we go backwards, is the time when the Beatles have their iconic photograph taken at Abbey Road when they're walking across the zebra crossing. And it, for me, encapsulates a moment in fashion history in a way, all these interesting shaped suits and things. But we're going to leave that for a moment. We're going to leave the Earth and we're going to go to your first scene. And this is at the Sea of Tranquility, the lunar surface, 2:56 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, July the 21st, 1969. I think we know what might be happening, but can you describe the scene for us, please?
Yes, so the scene is kind of, you can sort of see it from two perspectives. There's the scene taken from the individual himself, and then you've also got millions of people. I think it's something 528 million people, which is 15% of the world's population at the time, 95% of America's population, are tuned in, watching on small TV screens this moment in time, which is completely defines an era. And it's the moment when a human foot steps on a surface away from the Earth, steps onto the moon's surface, and you get this really sort of famous line, that's one small step for possibly a man or man, one giant leap for mankind. And that is just an incredible scene, and it changed the way people thought about the Earth. It changed the way, you know, suddenly you get this idea that people could maybe one day live away from the Earth. And this is sort of the moment when you can kind of almost imagine a thread snapping in people's minds. People suddenly were realizing that humans weren't necessarily and forever tethered to their own planet. And that's a huge conceptual leap, to suddenly imagine that we could be apart from our own world, even just temporarily, even if it isn't now, if it's in the future. To see a human being make this one step is just a phenomenal moment, and I think its impact really can't be overstated.
Yeah, crystallized, of course, by that famous quote, which is, it's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Although there's some argument whether there was a man and whether it came through in the recording. Is that right?
It was meant to be a man. Apparently that's the line that had been practiced and had been rehearsed. But they've listened back to recordings and they've listened to that sort of second before man to see if there's a in there. Yeah. But they can't find it. And so they think that in the heat of the moment, the A went AWOL.
Which is a strange case perhaps of a misquote in proving the quote, perhaps, because it becomes, rather than being just about Neil Armstrong, of course, who is this astronaut, to being something more transcendental about the whole of man, if you want to use that slightly antiquated term, breaking boundaries. It is, as you say, 240,000 miles away from where we're sitting now on the surface of the moon, and it's an incredibly powerful and vibrant scene. You've got the extreme blackness of space. Mm. What else can you describe about the scene?
Well, we've got this sort of, there's a bit of a paucity of the description, because if you go back and look at the transcripts and listen to what he was describing, it sort of grey. The vocabulary is very, it's not very poetic, it's not very descriptive. So he talks about the different shades of grey that he can see, and you've got this kind of sooty consistency of the surface of the moon. And then he talks about sort of being more ashen grey over there and kind of a paler grey over here. That's what he's seeing. He's seeing grey, he's seeing the blackness around him. And it's a very extreme environment, because obviously depending on whether you're in kind of a light spot or a dark spot, the temperature varies hugely, what you can see varies hugely. But also his own vision is limited because he's in the suit, so he can hear the kind of the hum of all the workings of the suit, and you know, is looking through the sort of the face shield, which is coated with gold to stop his vision getting affected by ultraviolet light and so on and so forth. So it's a very limited view, but an incredible moment nonetheless.
It's a great moment of accomplishment, almost the realization of that old idea that this was going to be the American century, and well, that's how it kind of turned out, really, because it doesn't get much better than landing on the moon in a way. And you talk about this is maybe through Armstrong's eyes, you get the I was going to say 50 Shades of Grey, that's maybe not quite right, but you know what I mean. And but there's also the other view as well, which is the people who are watching back home.
You know, it must have been so stressful. Not only have you got to accomplish this thing that no other person has accomplished before, people have been planning for, hundreds of people, millions of dollars have gone into this moment, but you've also got to make it look good to an audience back home, to the world's audience.
There was a bit of a surprise, not just for them then, but for other people who went to the moon subsequently, that they'd gone all this way and they kind of found themselves looking back to the Earth. That happened as well, didn't it?
Well, I think that's sort of the magic of it. I think that's one of the reasons why I picked this year, and I think it's, this moment is just so sublime, is when you're looking back at the Earth from outer space, suddenly you see the Earth as being quite fragile. It's this, you know, it's described as sort of the, you know, this blue marble in space, and you get that very famous photograph of the Earth kind of looking very small and very fragile. And I think that also really surprised people, because suddenly you feel quite protective of the Earth, and you get this, there's this huge wave of environmentalism and thinking about how we need to protect the Earth that kind of comes along after this. And I think that's not accidental. You suddenly think about how fragile and how precious the Earth is. And I think that understanding could really only come from having seen it from the moon, and from having, you know, seen it in this very different way, from a very different perspective. And that's what this moment afforded us.
It's striking, isn't it? We travelled so far to maybe understand ourselves a little bit better. And there's two quotes that speak to this I just love, and I'm going to have to read them to you now. And this, the first one's from Neil Armstrong, and he says, "It suddenly struck me that the tiny pea, pretty and blue, was the Earth. I put up my thumb and shut one eye, and my thumb blotted out the planet Earth. I didn't feel like a giant. I felt very, very small," which is a very visual image, but a striking one, I think. And the second is from Alexei Leonov, who was a Russian cosmonaut from a bit earlier on. And he talks of the Earth being small, light blue, and being so touchingly alone, our home that must be defended like a holy relic. The Earth was absolutely round, I believe. I never knew what the word round meant until I saw Earth from space. Yeah, these just help, I suppose, contextualise that moment. And the kind of the spiritual change that it makes within people, and the way that they conceive their reality as well. So I think going there on that day is a pretty good choice. Maybe you'd be sharing these things, maybe you'd be putting your thumb up to your eye as well, I don't know. But what we're going to talk about next, and this is your second scene, is really something that gets to the technological heart of the matter as well, and something that people perhaps haven't thought about quite so much, but you've certainly written about. And this is at the John F. Kennedy Space Center on the 16th of July, 1969, which is a little bit earlier on. So we're going back a bit further in time. What's happening there?
Well, I sort of wanted to take you from this sublime moment when man took their first step onto the moon to the kind of the preparation. So a few days beforehand, it's very early in the morning, and you have all these spacesuit technicians dressing the astronauts for this voyage into space. And they're in a kind of in a trailer. They're checking these suits incredibly carefully, because at this moment of walking on the moon's surface, you know, an intrinsic part of that were these spacesuits that had been created to kind of be like flexible one-person spacecraft that would allow people to leave the spacecraft and walk on the moon's surface. But, you know, for that to happen, these garments had to be checked over incredibly carefully. You know, every seam was examined, every zipper was run up and down to make sure it wasn't going to snag. And also the astronauts then had to be, you know, physically dressed, which was quite a, you know, an undertaking. It was sort of six different steps. There was Neil Armstrong, of course, Buzz Aldrin, and also Michael Collins, who didn't walk on the moon's surface, but he sort of stayed up above in the craft. But they all had to apply salve to their bodies because the layers of clothing they were about to put on would chafe unless they salved themselves up. Then they had to put on diapers, and NASA, who, you know, as an organization, they love very complicated language. So these diapers in NASA language are called maximum absorbency garments. Next up, they have to put on sacks that will collect the urine. So, you know, obviously they're going to pee. You can't have a fly in a spacesuit for obvious reasons. So they have kind of urine sacks. And actually, I sort of hid it in a footnote because I didn't want to be tasteless. But since we're on a podcast, I feel like I can okay, let loose. But there was something slightly odd about these urine sacks. They sort of came in different sizes. And initially, these sizes were called small, medium, and large.
Right.
But they discovered after this mission that there was a problem with that because no one wanted to admit that they needed the small. So now these urine sacks, which sort of, you know, put over the penis, are called large, extra large, and extra, extra large.
Oh, it's a bit like the, okay.
So, that's just a little fun fact for you there. But over this kind of, you know, slightly embarrassing array, you know, you're about to go into space to land on the moon, and you've just covered yourself in salve, you've put on a diaper, you've put on your urine sack, you then put on cotton long johns, and these were to sort of help the skin to breathe and to sort of be comfortable, or as comfortable as humanly possible to be, under the suit. And next comes the suit itself. And these are incredibly tricky garments. One of the people who had developed the suit said that, you know, we're all trained from birth to wear clothes, but no one has been trained to wear a spacesuit. And they're so cumbersome that it requires quite a lot of assistance to put them on. So it's almost this kind of very odd thing that these men who are about to go and do this incredible thing are kind of being treated in a little way like babies. They're having sort of lotions put on, and they've got their cotton long johns, and they, you know, are dressed by other people.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then the final moment is putting on the gloves and the headwear. And so, again, you have this, it's very human and very intimate and kind of humbling in a very different way. You've had this sublime moment of men kind of able to put their thumbs over the tiny pea of the earth. And then you've got a few days before what had allowed this to be possible, which is three men being dressed, physically dressed, and sort of rubbed over with lotion by other people, and the garments themselves, which will allow them to land on the moon and to walk on the moon, but are cumbersome and horrible. And all the astronauts describe this kind of love-hate relationship and feeling kind of claustrophobic in these suits, as you can well imagine.
Well, I think that's a really interesting idea that, you know, to do something which is extraordinary, you have to first really regress to a state of childhood or whatever. I'm thinking of, you know, probably like less than 2-year-olds, completely helpless to have everything done for them. So that's interesting in itself. How long would the process of getting dressed take? Do you have any idea?
Well, this whole process took a very long time. They actually started at about 3:30 in the morning. But actually, two of the astronauts, Armstrong and Aldrin, who had to exit, put on a slightly different suit, which would allow them to be outside the spacecraft, had to completely undress when they landed on the moon's surface and redress in a slightly different suit that had extra layers that would allow them then to get outside the vehicle. And that process took them far longer than they realised it would take. It actually took 3 hours for them to undress and then to redress in order to exit the vehicle.
So this all sounds very cumbersome in a way, but absolutely essential, because if there's one flaw in any of the spacesuits, the results could be catastrophic. And I know that you document various cases where there were problems with some of the spacesuits at this time, and the results were always really traumatic for the astronaut, and sometimes even worse still. Like, the idea of watching them getting changed before they go is a, like, a very strange prequel to the whole thing.
It is, and also, you know, accidents happened even in that moment. So I can't remember which of the two it was, whether it was Armstrong or Aldrin, but one of them turned around literally just as they were about to exit and to step on the moon's surface, and they broke a lever. And so when they took off again, back to sort of go back into orbit and get back into the spacecraft, they had to improvise and use kind of a pencil to push a button, to, you know, in place of this lever that had been broken, because, you know, he describes it as being like two fully dressed footballers in like a little tent, you know, and you just think that there's no space, and you're having to do... you know, to put on all these incredibly cumbersome clothes that are absolutely essential. And, you know, there's a lot of different steps involved. In fact, they had on their gloves, they had sort of Velcro to-do lists to remind them of all the things that they had to do.
Well, Velcro was important, wasn't it?
It was at that time. They had to sort of adapt it, actually, okay. Sort of halfway through the Apollo mission, because there'd been this horrendous accident in, I think, 1967, where on Earth, during sort of some routine testing, there'd been this massive conflagration. What had been realised was that a lot of the materials that were going to be in this oxygen-rich environment in spacecraft needed to be incredibly fire-resistant, far more fire-resistant than we'd ever need on Earth. This is still true to this day. You know, all the fabrics that are routinely used on Earth in, say, firefighting equipment is too flammable for space. And so things like Velcro, the Velcro that we might use, although it's incredibly useful and had been sort of conceived as incredibly useful in space because you could stick things down and stop it floating away, had to be kind of altered slightly so that it would be less flammable.
Did the astronauts talk about this process, and if it was a humbling one, did they tolerate it well, or were they complaining in their journals, do you know?
So they're quite jocular about it. They do talk about the kind of ridiculousness of these processes of getting dressed, and also of the suit themselves. There's this wonderful book by Michael Collins called Carrying the Fire. He was actually quite involved. Each of the astronauts in the Apollo mission were involved with a different part of the process, and his kind of remit were the suits. And so he knew quite a lot about them and had visited the factories where they were made and all the rest of it. And so he knew a fair amount about it. And so in this book, he talks and jokes quite a lot about the process of making them, about wearing them, about how claustrophobic they were, and these really sort of human details of what it was like to be in these suits, and also how they felt about them. Because, you know, on the one hand, they hate them, they're cumbersome, they're horrible, they're hot, they're heavy, they're difficult to move in, but they are also completely essential to survival. Mm. Because human beings are not made to live in space. I've already talked about the huge fluctuations in temperature, which on the moon's surface can go from 157 degrees below to 154 degrees above zero. You've also got the ultraviolet radiation, you haven't got breathable atmosphere, you're also at risk of being struck by a micrometeorite at any moment. Okay. You've got the lack of gravity, which can cause nausea and sickness. And sickness can sound quite kind of minor, but if you're being sick into a kind of a bubble helmet, which is also your breathable atmosphere, then that's quite a serious thing. You know, you risk choking on your own vomit. No one wants that. And so NASA had taken this incredibly seriously, and they'd had sort of convened a subcommittee on nausea during this Apollo mission. Also, lack of gravity wasn't so relevant for the Apollo astronauts because they were only going to be in space for a short period of time. But over a longer period of time, it really affects your bone density. So you're losing about 2 or 3% of your bone density every month that you're kind of in a zero gravity situation. And there's also existing in a vacuum, which causes the body to swell. If your liquids on the surface of your eyes or in your mouth, for example, are exposed to a vacuum, they start to sizzle. And also your brain cells are dying when you're in a vacuum, which is actually a problem that people who climb Everest tackle, because when you're that high up above the surface, you're kind of going into this kind of vacuum-like situation, your body just can't handle it, and your brain cells start to die. And
so
that
quite the list, really, of considerations. But yes. I think, you know, you're touching on things which just make the story so interesting, and these are the paradoxes that we spoke about earlier, the idea that, you know, first of all, to maybe do something which is really sophisticated, you have to be taken back to a state, yes. You have to submit to almost anything, to a baby-like state. But then the second point is that, in a way, we conceive the trip to the moon as being a moment of liberation, of freedom, of us breaking out of our little planet and showing that, okay, we're not confined to the planet Earth. Whatever our future as a species may be, it might even be on different planets. And And at the same time, you're saying to have that level of freedom, you need to have all these restrictions placed upon you. So this is the interest to me of like the story which is coming through. You mentioned Michael Collins, and there's a nice quote that you mentioned from him when he talks about the suit protecting its occupant against all hazards. It's all that stands between the little soft pink body of an astronaut and the hard vacuum of space. And that kind of juxtaposition between the two, it just makes you realise how frail we are and in what a ridiculous context these astronauts were about to find themselves, a dangerous one.
And also the design challenge of these suits, you know, because you have got to protect this thing that's very fragile, but it's also got to be flexible enough for us to move. You know, we're a very odd shape with all our sort of, you know, our legs and our hands, and we've got to be able to move our fingers and use all these things. So a suit that can allow that is an incredible thing.
Yeah, and when you go back to the original quotes from Armstrong when he was on the moon, he's talking about moving things like powdery things with his feet, under his toes. So there is a level of flexibility and dexterity that he's found within the suits. So it shows what amazing things they really, really were. How much would one of these cost?
Yeah, so they were all custom made, you know, for the individual. Mm. And depending on the sort of the level of complexity, you know, how odd a shape you were, and also whether it was going to be used inside or outside, it would cost anywhere between $100,000 and $250,000. Right. And they used to joke that if it was priced like steak, it would be about $1,000 per pound, which I think is actually not quite right, but gives you a sense of how they were thinking about it.
Well, there they are getting dressed at the JFK Space Center. Another quote you've got is they look like businessmen on the way to the future, which I think is a really nice laconic image, if we like. Let's go from that.
Yeah, that I have to sort of give a shout out to, there's this amazing book called Fashioning Apollo, and that quote is taken from that. And it was just, you know, that was, I came across this book when I was kind of deciding which moment. I knew I wanted a chapter about space, and I came across this book, and it's just wonderfully written, and I would highly advise anyone who's interested in this and interested in the broader, deeper history of just spacesuits to rush out immediately and buy this book. It is wonderful.
And what's it called again?
It's called Fashioning Apollo.
Fashioning Apollo. Brilliant. Well, make a note of that one. We've established, first of all, that this is an iconic moment, and second, that there was a lot of preparation involved. I think you're going to tell us a bit more about how that happened now, because we're going to go to your third scene, which is the sewing floor of Playtex in Delaware. Is this right?
Yes.
So can you tell us a bit more about why we're there? And what's happening?
So in order to reach this moment in 1969, on July 21st, when mankind steps out and walks on the surface of the moon, there'd been this huge run-up. And the process of getting to a suit that was able to allow a human being to do that was really the sort of very long-winded process and really a sort of case of evolution. You know, spacesuits evolved out of high altitude flying suits that had been developed, you know, or were beginning to be developed during the tail end of the Second World War. But during the Apollo mission itself, in order to get this rather, you know, cuddly looking white Omega suit that was the suit that Armstrong and Aldrin wore, there was this really behind the scenes scramble over the course of the 60s. So you have lots of different firms who were desperate to be the ones who were designing the spacesuits for NASA that would allow mankind to walk on the moon. And the eventual winner of all this scrambling was really unlikely. They were called the International Latex Company, or better known to the world as Playtex, a maker of women's underwear, which a lot of people find incredibly surprising, and you know, I can understand why. So this is a company best known for making women's bras and girdles. They also made a lot of diapers, but they were able to turn those skills into winning the contract, this highly prized contract, against other contractors who had worked with NASA before and had made other spacesuits for them before. But Playtex were the ones who eventually won. They were a very small company. I think in 1961 they only had 50 people working there, and then they increase tenfold. By 1969 they're a very big company, and a lot of the focus of the company has turned towards making these Apollo suits. And I wanted to focus particularly on the sewing floor, because I think what's so incredible about these spacesuits is kind of, in a way, how, when you break it down, how kind of homespun and low tech they really are. Even when they were working on Apollo 11 astronaut suits, they were working on Singer sewing machines that had been specially adapted in order to just fire one stitch at a time, because the work was so painstaking. But if you think about the Omega suit, if you break it down into its component parts, the one that goes onto the moon surface is comprised of 21 separate layers and 4,000 different pieces of fabric. All of these have to exactly align, have to be completely airtight, and have to fit the individual who they're made for.
Wow.
And to make this even more difficult, you know, that's hard enough. I'm currently trying to teach myself how to sew with a sewing machine, and I'm struggling to even, you know, make a dress. But, you know, to make this even harder, a lot of the ways in which they had been trained to work weren't allowed to them. So in 1967, a rogue pin was discovered between two layers of fabric in one of the test suits for the Apollo 11 mission. And obviously, these suits have to be airtight. They have to protect the astronaut from the vacuum outside, and they have to be pressurized. So finding a rogue pin, you know, when you've got a kind of a latex layer that has to be fully a complete seal, is a real problem. And so pins thereafter were rationed and in some cases even forbidden. And an X-ray machine was installed on the sewing floor in order that every layer of fabric that was being produced would be put through this X-ray machine to make sure that there were no pins between the layers. As, you know, as this is happening, there's constant kind of dialogue between the astronauts and between NASA and between Playtex and the employees of Playtex. So, you know, for example, halfway through the process, when they're working on the Omega suit, they realise that they're, even with the salve, there's a real chafing problem, and that the astronauts are becoming injured by the suits. And so what they do is they take some of the fluffy liner that was commonly used to make women's girdles more comfortable, and they insert this in the Omega suit. So that technology that was designed to make women's girdles more comfortable ends up on the moon.
This is quite a peculiar twist on a story we think we know in various ways. And I mean, it is slightly comic to put these things together, you know, the makers of women's underwear with the Apollo space missions. But there's a lot of sense in it if you think it through, and the precision. And you talk about, even within this workforce, there's maybe three or four of the employees who were considered to be of a sufficient level of skill to do the more, you know, kind of complicated tasks in the process. If you were there, I suppose, watching them doing the work, I suppose there'd be a sense of pride and excitement in the work that they're doing as well. Because, of course, we have to remember back to the beginning of the decade when JFK made his famous claim about this is going to be the decade when we put a man on the moon. And in a way, with that clear objective in sight, it must have been a job full of pride and excitement for them. Would you say so?
Absolutely. So there was sort of this oral history project that took place in, I think, the early 70s, you know, talking to a lot of the people who had been involved. And one of the people they spoke to was a man called Mel Case, who worked for Playtex. And he said that, you know, this was the high point of his life. And I can imagine that the same would be true, you know, for all these women. What an odd career trajectory. You start off in a company that makes women's bras, and then you end up, because you have the particular dexterity, or because, you know, for whatever reason, you end up working on the suits that are going to allow what in 1969 is this incredible moment of human beings breaking free from the Earth.
And of course, they would have watched those images from July 1969, probably looking at slightly different bits of the picture to the flag. Oh. Everyone's looking at the flag fluttering or not, as it would be. They might be looking at the seams and the stitches. I don't know.
How nerve-wracking. How nerve-wracking must that have been? You know, if anything goes wrong with the suit.
Well, it's like the ultimate in a kind of test scenario, isn't it? And there was a lot of people watching. One of the reviews of your book, they said it's a quietly feminist book. And I think this is an interesting dimension of what we just mentioned briefly, because in a sense it's quite a man-based story, the whole moon landings, because the astronauts are male. Often, if you cut to mission control in Houston, you often see these men behind those rows of desks that we're familiar with. But here, what you're doing, which I found really, well, it taught me a lot, was showing how a lot of traditional skills and a lot of women were involved in this process, often invisibly, as is often the case in science. But these are skills which stretch back maybe for generations. The mission wouldn't have been able to go forward without them. Is that right?
Yeah, and you can actually look, if you go online and go to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, you can see pictures of the suits, the actual suits that went up. They kind of allow you to sort of zoom right in. And you can zoom in on Armstrong's suit, the very one that he wore for the moon landing. And you can see the tiny stitches that held it all together. And that is that's an incredible thing, if you think about it. If you think about stitches, something so human and so small and so old-fashioned, but that underpins this incredible technological achievement.
Absolutely. It kind of connects the story to a massive heritage, doesn't it?
Which it does.
I think is, as you point out, what Fabric's always done through history is kind of, I don't know, it's a horrible pun to say this, but interweaves with the human story, and at times it will enable you to do different things in different ways. So I suppose it's two things, it's the fabric and the techniques as well coming together. Yep. And I suppose half the attraction of being in Playtex and seeing the sewing room floor would be to watch all of that in process.
Yeah, I just love to, when you think about what that must have sounded like, what that must have felt like, you know, the kind of the chats people were having. If you think about meeting these women, I became completely obsessed when I was writing this book with these women. I kept on trying to track them down via Facebook. I sort of was going through people's friend lists to see if I could find some of them and talk to some of them. I really wanted to talk to them, and I didn't manage it. And I, you know, if anyone's listening and you want to get in touch, please do. But I just felt like this is sort of one of these stories that deserves telling and deserves, you know, wider recognition. You know, we now know about the women computers, as they were known, who were doing all these incredibly complex calculations for the trajectories and that would be necessary to land on the moon and then get home safely. Well, this is another similar story, and I think people can kind of think, okay, well, the women who are doing the computations, the mathematical sums, that kind of is inherently, you know, people have a lot of respect for maths. But I think, again, going back to this very first thing that I said when I came on this podcast about this kind of dismissal, in a way, of fabric, of textiles, you know, people dismiss these skills. I wanted to tell this story because, to me, it really says so much about the incredible capacity that these skills have. You know, yes, you can make something very humble and very simple, you know, and stitch something together, but using the very same skills and, you know, some of the same techniques and also some of the same instruments, like the Singer sewing machine, you can also make a suit that is suitable for outer space.
Perfect. Well, massively enlightening. Michael Collins's book's a really, really good one you mentioned before, when he goes through various aspects of this, because it seems to be his portion of the story was to look after the suits. And there's another quote from his, which I think is a nice way to round off this story of Playtex. And when he says, when you think of a spacewalker, you may visualize a chap confidently exploiting the most advanced technology that this rich and powerful nation can provide. But not me, friends. I see a covey of old ladies hunched over their glue pots in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I only hope that between their discussions of Friday night at bingo and the new Monsignor, their attention doesn't wander too far. So he's finding a comic strain in that little quote. But it's a nice spin, isn't it, on the history we think we know so well.
It is. It humanises it, and it's humorous as well. But it's also sad that he sort of talks about kind of a covey of old ladies, because it, in a way, I mean, I love the book and I love the humour that he brings to it, and I also love the attention that he brings to it, but it's also heartbreaking that the incredible skill and attention to detail that they must have put into
is diminished
in the anecdote, and that makes me a little bit sad. But I still recommend the book, and for me, those women making the suits are heroes, and we should know their names and know a lot more about them than we do.
Well, I agree with you completely there. That's a brilliant story, because really what you're doing is unpacking a familiar, iconic scene, as you say, going from the moon landing itself back to mission control. But then really the most important scene of all, because you wouldn't be able to get any further, is really the sewing room floor in Playtex, isn't it? Because that's where really, in a way, the moon landings started, in some sense, in a practical sense at least. So thank you for that. We're going to leave our time travels, but I'm going to ask you a few supplementary questions. And the first of all is, if you could bring one thing back to 2019 with you on your travels, or from your travels, I should say, what would you like to bring?
I think I would like to bring back the sort of affectionately known as the Snoopy caps, but they're these little hats that are worn by the astronauts underneath their helmets, and they sort of look like old-fashioned swimming caps in a way. But I think that is an incredibly human but also amazing piece of history to bring back, you know, one of the Snoopy caps that was taken out to the moon.
Well, we'll let you have one of those, that's no problem. And well, last of all, the book. This is just one of the stories in there, and you go really right through human history, don't you, and talk about the interactions between, I suppose, sometimes quite well-known stories and the hidden role that Fabric is playing within those. Is that right?
Yes. So, yes, it covers kind of a vast time span, but it doesn't go all the way through. It sort of tells 13 very different stories. The story of the spacesuits is just one of them. I also talk about the obsession with spider silk and the attempt to create synthetic silk that can be the fabric of the future. I talk about lace makers. I talk about the very first fibers that we believe that human beings ever touched, which were found sort of in the soil of a cave in Georgia. So it's kind of an array of very different stories with fabric at the heart of each and every one of them, showing that fabric deserves more of our attention, deserves more of our respect than perhaps we give it. You know, this is something that we depend on. We're all sitting here in this room recording this podcast fully clothed, wearing clothes. That's something that people do every day. They get up, they put on clothes. We interact with fabric every moment of our lives, pretty much. And yet we don't often think about it that much, or think about how incredible it is, or where it's come from, or who's handled it on its way to us. And I think that's kind of odd.
It is. It's I suppose it's when you look back and you look forward at the same time, and you get this great sense of course, it's always with us there every day. We're always making use of this, and we're doing it in different contexts. And I suppose from reading your book, I was thinking about where fabric's going in the future. Where are we going to go now? I mean, you've got an example right at the beginning when you talk about the smart trousers and things like this. Didn't work out very well, did they?
So there's just been some recent testing on textiles that could kind of alert people to air quality and stuff like that. So there are some really interesting and futuristic ideas that are going into this. But I think very often the ones that get most publicised are the silly things that, you know, are never going to work. Like, maybe touchscreen trousers are the way forward. But, you know, there are incredible things that textiles might be able to do for us in the future. But perhaps also they'll just carry on being humble and not much regarded, but essential to our lives, and that would be no less, you know, honourable for textiles.
Absolutely, but we've seen today how they can elevate us to pretty much as high as we can go. So I think that's a story worth remembering, and thank you very much for talking to us today, Cassia.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that was me, Peter Moore, talking to Cassia St. Clair in London about 1969 and those amazing Omega spacesuits just the other day. It was the first time, really, that we'd given up the comforts of planet Earth for the enticements of outer space, if you like. And I hope you enjoyed our conversation. I learnt a lot. If you did, you can leave us a rating or a comment. We'd love to hear from you. And of course, you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Spotify and any of the other usual podcasting platforms. We'll have another episode for you in a fortnight's time. That's Tuesday, the 30th of April. And then we're going to be travelling much further back, and that's to the 12th century AD to see the famed crusader Sultan Saladin. We're going to be taken there by the academic historian Professor Jonathan Phillips from Royal Holloway University. He's written a wonderful book on Saladin, and that's, I think, going to be a really satisfying episode, full of interesting things. But from me, and for now, that's it. Thank you very, very much for listening in.
I'm Paul Lay, the editor of History Today. On our website, you'll find articles written by experts relating to Cassius St. Clair's troubles. You can read Serena Dyer on the array of clothing available in 18th century London. Alinka Rublak traces the origins of power dressing, while André Balloy explains how the moon landings of 1969 were the product of an age of optimism and daring. Links to all of these pieces can be found at www.historytoday.com/travels, and there are many more articles on every aspect of the past in our monthly publication, History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine.
There it is, it's coming up.
What?
The Earth.
See it?
Yeah. Beautiful.